The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
National security conservatives were the ones who were seemed to be the most likely to oppose Trump. And that's where you really need to not think of them as individuals, right? But that there's really, you know, sort of social glue in that group. These are people who know each other. They interact with each other. They've served in government together, right? They've been in the equivalent of the foxhole with each other. They have, in that sense, a lot of kind of lateral influence on each other, right? There was a real unit cohesion in that group. So if you want to explain the behavior of any individual, you really need to think about the collectivity of which they're a part. And people in that world really did exercise influence on each other, right? They did try to establish norms for their community, right, about why they as a collectivity should oppose Trump. And I think sociologically, they were just more used to thinking about themselves as a group in that sense.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 23rd, 2020. Steve Tellis is the author of a new book with Robert P. Salden, Never Trump: Revolt of the Conservative Elites. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Tellis to discuss his new book. The pair talked about how the national security and legal communities approach Donald Trump, and how these two schools of thought have informed the Never Trump movement. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 23rd. Steve Tellis on Never Trump.
Before we get into your current book, I want to start with your prior book, which I believe was your first, on the rise of the conservative legal movement. Because this, at least as I see this book for you, it is part of a longer term project of kind of chronicling the development of the intellectual side of conservatism. And so talk a little bit about this project in relation to your prior project.
Yeah, so the book I think you're referring to is 2008, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, which in fact is my second book after my dissertation. And I've had a long, ever since I graduated in January 1995, and going back to grad school, I've had a long interest in American conservatism. And I should mention that I studied with conservatives, which is an increasingly unusual phenomenon. My advisors in grad school were Jim Caesar and Martha Derthick and Steve Rhodes, who were all intellectual conservatives. And so I've had an opportunity to sort of look at this and study American conservatism, especially intellectual conservatism, from the inside. And in the book in 2008, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, the question I asked was, how did conservatives counter-mobilize against the growth of legal liberalism? And I think this framing is something that's often missing when people are studying conservatives. They, especially because liberals generally view themselves increasingly as the losers of American history. And so it's hard for them to imagine just how disadvantaged conservatives felt when you went back to the 1960s and 70s, especially in areas, in professional and intellectual areas, the degree to which they felt that liberals really dominated those parts of American society. And so as conservatives were winning elections all across the country, the Reagan Revolution, they were increasing in their electoral power, they still found their ability to actually get policy results substantially constrained by the fact that liberals controlled not only professions like the law, but all kinds of institutions that fed into those domains, right? Law schools, public interest law firms, insulated bureaucratic institutions across government. And so the challenge that conservatives had was, how do you counter-mobilize when there's a limited degree to which you can simply use an electoral lever to affect those domains? And so what I asked in the book in the Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement was, how did conservatives go about building a kind of counter-mobilizing structure to the quite enormous structures that legal liberalism had built?
And in the course of doing this, one of the things about that book was just the number of figures in the development of that movement that you interviewed, and that you interviewed from a kind of institutional development point of view. And that seems to translate pretty directly to how you and your co-author approached this project on the Never Trump movement. There are an amazing number of people who you sat down with over what looks like 2.5-3 years to discuss what makes them different from the direction that the mainstream Republican Party went. So, like, talk about this project in the aggregate, and then we're going to burrow down into a few discrete areas of it.
Yeah. So a lot of the, again, you go back to the Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, that book was based both on interviews and on extensive archival materials. In fact, not even really archival materials, in that most of them were not actually in any formal archive. They were in organizational file cabinets here, there, and everywhere. And my strategy was not really to focus on the actual ideas that these people had. There have been plenty of, you know, intellectual histories of conservatives written, but they have a real organizational focus. The basic idea was that ideas are fine, but somebody actually has to keep the lights on and actually make organizations that are capable of doing something with those ideas. And so in that book, I looked at the Federalist Society, the Institute for Justice, Center for Individual Rights, the Law and Economics Center. And I really did take an approach that's, you know, more common, especially in sociology, of, you know, resource mobilization. How did people acquire resources? How did they deploy them? And so I was less interested in the big picture, big thinker people than the people who are actually in the guts of the machine making it work. So some of those, right, there's overlap in that. But I think the main thing I did is I tried to understand the world as these people saw it, to the degree to which I could. I tried to imaginatively operate inside the constraints and opportunities that they saw, and to reconstruct what that looked like at the time. And so that's a lot of what Rob Saldin, my co-author, and I tried to do here. Now, again, because we're writing essentially real-time social science here, we don't have, you know, with one large exception, which we may talk about in national security, we didn't really have archival materials to go on. So we had to draw on people's own memories. But we did try as much as possible to burrow inside of people's own way of looking at the world.
And the question that the book seems to focus on, and it focuses on it across a number of discrete professional disciplines, is what made the Never Trump conservatives different from the other conservatives that ultimately accommodated themselves to the Trump movement? What made them distinctive, and how have they reacted? And I'm interested in your kind of gestalt answer to that question. If you look at a conservative intellectual or political activist or a former government official, what are the salient variables most likely to predict whether that person becomes a Never Trump figure or becomes a person willing to accommodate him or herself to the direction that the party has gone under President Trump?
Yeah, so the book is organized around these, what we might call professional service providers to the modern Republican Party. And so there's partially a theory about party that's underneath that, which is that under current conditions, parties depend on a quite extensive network of people to do the expert work of politics and public policy. And that's not incidental to the answer to your question, which is we did find pretty systematic differences across these different professional service providers. So in the book, national security conservatives were the ones who were the seemed to be the most likely to oppose Trump. And that's where you really need to not think of them as individuals, right? But that there's really, you know, sort of social glue in that group. These are people who know each other. They interact with each other. They've served in government together, right? They've been in the equivalent of the foxhole with each other. They have, in that sense, a lot of kind of lateral influence on each other, right? There was a real unit cohesion in that group. So if you want to explain the behavior of any individual, you really need to think about the collectivity of which they're a part. And people in that world really did exercise influence on each other, right? They did try to establish norms for their community, right, about why they as a collectivity should oppose Trump. And I think sociologically, they were just more used to thinking about themselves as a group in that sense. And again, national security conservatives also had some very particular reasons to oppose Trump. Again, one, they had, lots of them had very significant suspicions that he was not altogether, I'm trying to find a delicate way to put this, not, you know, not altogether a entirely committed to American interest, as opposed to, again, especially in the campaign, of those of Russia, right? The other part was that these are people who, for whom, you know, government service really mattered, and they really did think about the commander in chief as having a kind of moral authority. And they really couldn't imagine, having been in the Situation Room, having been in the West Wing, right? They just couldn't imagine taking moral direction from Donald Trump. And so in the book, we distinguish that from lawyers whose own professional practice is much more likely to involve thinking about the person they work with as a client. And, you know, clients of lawyers are quite frequently not people of particular moral authority. And lawyers are used to thinking about part of their professional socialization as being able to separate out their client from their own personal moral authority, that they have some other source of moral authority other than what's derived from that of the person that they're working for. So I do think those professional categories don't get you all the way to explaining everyone, but they give you a good gross division of these groups into who was more likely to sort of make their peace with Donald Trump and who were the real irreconcilables.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. Like, I'm going to focus on two of these professional categories because they're the two that that Lawfare deals with. We're going to leave out the economists and the political operatives and talk about only the national security professionals and the lawyers. But I do think like that is an interesting bracket, because at some level, the national security folks are the people who have the least to gain from Trump, in the sense that they are the ones who are most sensitive to the delicacy of presidential decision making in crisis. They are also the ones who, you know, as you guys describe in the book, they're pretty committed in a kind of nonpartisan way to what you might call the liberal world order and certain structures that American presidents have created across parties. These are things that Trump has threatened and really has open contempt for. And so they have the kind of the least to gain from it and the most to lose. Whereas the lawyers are a really interesting case, because on the one hand, there's all these principles that lawyers purport to believe in, rule of law stuff that Trump is pretty threatening to. But on the other hand, you know, what conservative lawyers get out of the Trump administration is no small thing, which is judicial appointments that they're genuinely excited about. And so I'm interested for your sense in, you know, how much of this at the end of the day is structural, that like certain professions had more to gain from Trump and certain professions had more to lose, and how much of it is the aggregation of what you just described, which is social networks, which is once, you know, once some national security types are circulating letters, the famous Never Trump letters, there's social pressure to join that. And so that community ends up really going on the record in a way that others did not. So at the end of the day, how much of it is personal and how much of it is these sort of structural forces that you describe?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the structural things are the necessary first cut. And I'm going to go through, there was a lot packed in there, so I'll try and go through it systematically. I mean, one thing with the national security conservatives that's really important is that, you know, it was somewhat easy for them to oppose Trump because Trump had already poked them in the eye. If you look at the reconstruction of Republican conservatism that Trump was proposing in national security, it had very large consequences, right? So on the one hand, in policy terms, Trump was proposing a very large alteration of American foreign policy that was directly opposite to what most of these people believed in. So that's one thing. The second thing, and connected to it, is that Trump was directly questioning their professional authority, right? Or in sociological terms, their jurisdiction, right? That is, most conservatives before, at least for decades before, had essentially accepted the jurisdiction of this particular network of experts, right? And that's a kind of a complicated formulation, but one way to think about that is if you were running for president in the last, you know, quite many cycles, part of the legitimation ritual you would go through in running for president is you would surround yourself with a bunch of these kind of people to show that you were a serious candidate. You would get advice for them. You would advertise that you were in seminars with them where they would explain to you like what's going on in Yemen and the American force posture in the South Pacific and all that, right? So that was really their jurisdiction. And Trump directly said, look, I'm not going to take advice from these people, right? These are yesterday's people. They got us into Iraq. They're all weak. I'm going to take advice from new kinds of people, right? So in national security, he had both rejected their ideas and he'd rejected their jurisdiction. So those two things are important. The other thing that's important about national security conservatives is, especially as compared to these other groups, their professional identity is, as you mentioned before, very much bipartisan, right? You know, they think they have a lot in common, at least with significant parts of the national security community on the other side, right, of the Democrats. They have lots of social processes that bring them into, you know, repeated interaction with them, right? Council on Foreign Relations, meetings and task forces, Aspen Institute, right? All those kinds of things. And internationally, right? They're going to international meetings of people on the left and right. And one thing we mention in the book is, in many ways, one thing that holds national security experts on both the right and the left together is a fear of popular involvement in national security, right? Both of them are, you know, believe that, you know, too much Democratic participation in national security is dangerous. And so they have this kind of guardian mentality. And that one thing they saw in Trump and in populism in general is the collapse of that insulation of foreign policy from too much Democratic involvement. And so I think that it goes a long way to explaining this particular worldview of this community when they saw Trump and why they reacted as strong as they did. And I think the lawyers are a little bit different.
Well, let's come to the lawyers in a minute. I want to further explore the national security folks, many of whom write for Lawfare, and you know, people have often said of Lawfare that it turned left, and by which they mean it became very national, you know, very anti-Trump. I think that is rather a reflection of a lot of the things that are going on in that chapter, that the national security community in general was quite shocked by Trump for a lot of the reasons that you described. There are certain baseline commitments. But I do think that there is another factor, which I alluded to in my earlier question, and which you talk about a little bit in the book, which is, you know, these are people who've been with presidents or senior officials during exquisitely difficult decisions, right? And there is a sense for them, in a way that maybe really isn't true for economists, that the character of the individual deeply matters. And, you know, I can see being an economist and saying, I don't care if a rogue who I wouldn't trust with my daughter in the room is doing the deregulation that I think is so important, or a good person is doing it. But when you've, you know, when you've sat with presidents in, or secretaries of state or secretaries of defense, in the kind of most difficult decisions they make based on imperfect information, and maybe they get things wrong in with tragic consequences, or maybe they get things right and you have great successes, but you do have this appreciation of the degree to which they are or are not considering the right variables, thinking about it in a way for which you have respect. And so I'm curious to what extent that is, and I noticed in some of the emails that you quote in the deliberations surrounding the Never Trump letters from the national security conservatives, there were a lot of references to that unfit, I can't do this, right? I or support my party's nominee. How much of it was a mismatch between the expectations of that community and the character of the individual?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the character of the individual here mattered a lot. And again, I do need to talk about the other groups just for comparative purposes. In the Economist chapter, we interviewed Douglas Holt Eakin, who had been a senior economic advisor to John McCain, you know, a person that clearly in the interview, you know, Holtzeken held McCain in extraordinarily high regard, and Trump had direct, you know, his one of his most offensive comments, which is the one that, you know, I prefer people who, you know, weren't, soldiers who weren't captured, in reply to McCain, right? That clearly, you know, hit Holtzeken pretty clearly. And yet one of the big themes of my interview with Douglas Holtzeken is that, you know, he has a line where he says, look, I got a list of stuff I want to get done. And, you know, I'm going to work with whoever to get those things done. Right. And again, part of that is so much of that agenda is legislative and therefore it's transactional. And I think especially somebody like Holtzeken was thinking, look, I could either, you know, fly my freak flag about how much I dislike Trump, or I could, you know, get a tax bill passed or regulatory reform or whatever. Right. But the legislative part of national security is just not nearly as important as the discretionary power that presidents exercise in moments of crisis and decision. And so that's why that sort of thing, I think, did loom much larger for those kinds of people, because they didn't think about the president mainly as a sort of device for the passage of policy closer to where their ideal preference point would be, right? And the other part that I think is really important, and we do emphasize in the book, is there's a line somewhere, I forget who used it, that said, you know, the lives, I think it was actually Phil Zelikow, that, you know, the lives of people in national security are one ritual and funeral after another, right? That's a huge part, that ritualistic, performative, you know, in a way, performance of honor is a really important part of the lives of these kinds of people, right? And the willingness of Trump to really not be willing to exercise that, right? Not willing to willing to step into the role. And you know, that's one of the things I think is characteristic about Trump, is Trump really rebels against role-appropriate behavior, right? About the idea that there's an inherited office that he's supposed to be acting on the basis of the norms that he's inherited. Trump really doesn't like that. And that's really important for these kinds of people. And so I think those all matter. And then the final thing that really just can't be underestimated is there just were a lot of these people who thought Trump was disloyal. And there's no gentle way to put that, where there just was a, you know, and this again, especially with these people, that, you know, is just an absolutely irreducible fact that, you know, other people in other professional communities wouldn't necessarily have had to see that. But the idea that all of the secrets of the country would be consumed by this person, right? And even if there was a slight, you know, worry that this person was not entirely loyal to the interests in the United States, that looms incredibly large for these people.
In a way that it doesn't necessarily for The Economist.
Yeah, right. I mean, again, in that sort of, I mean, look, now there were a lot of economists who deeply disliked Trump, and it is not an accident, right, that you had a way less representation by economists in this administration. Now, that's also a characteristic of Trump's own approach, right? When you think about what was it about inherited Republicanism that Trump was rejecting, he was both rejecting a lot of the economic of sort of classical economic approach of Republicans and the national security. And he was also rejecting their jurisdiction, the idea that this group of economists should get these senior positions. And so there are relatively few, you know, prominent Republican economists in this administration as compared to previous ones. But even then, right, economists are much more cynical about political leadership. Whereas I think these national security people really do, you know, think that character matters in a way that economists are much more likely to think about the entire political process as a market of exchange. And they didn't like Trump because Trump was not going to do with political power what they wanted, right? In the market of political exchange, he was going to be, you know, doing things like, you know, cutting our trade relationships with other countries, potentially doing more crony capitalism and the connection between his own economic interests and those of the United States. But he didn't offend them at a sort of really deep fundamental level because they had such a low expectation of political leadership in the first place.
All right, so let's turn to the other central Lawfare readership community that you treat in this, which is the lawyers. And if the national security conservatives are relatively monolithic in terms of their embrace of the Never Trump movement, there are, of course, exceptions, but it's really an area where, as you describe it in the book, this is the molten core of the Never Trump movement. Is the national security conservatives. The lawyers are a much more divided crew. And so first of all, describe the divisions and then describe the explanation for the divisions.
So, I mean, again, with lawyers, the most important thing to recognize, again, as compared to national security conservatives and economic conservatives, is that Trump had accepted both their ideas and their jurisdiction. Now, part of that has to do with the fact that Trump really does have a kind of almost reptilian sixth sense for power. Trump doesn't have a really coherent ideology. That's why I think he's better understood as a demagogue than some kind of fascist, like a lot of people want to think of him as. But he does have a sense of who has power and who he can push and demean and who he has to cut deals with. And social conservatives, and by extension, judicial and legal conservatives, are a group that he clearly looked at and said, these people have real power. These people really can hurt me and I have to cut a deal with them. And his proposed ideological reconstruction or sort of philosophical reconstruction of conservatism didn't actually involve a break from pre-existing legal beliefs, although certainly his performance of the office in some ways has. So the first thing to say is he didn't poke the lawyers in the eye. The second thing is he clearly, if anything, he expanded their jurisdiction. And that's why I think that the parts where he put out these lists of potential Supreme Court justices that he had gotten directly through, you know, Heritage, the Federal Society networks, that kind of stuff. That was a recognition of those people's jurisdiction, right? That was in a way of him bending the knee to them. And that's, I think, one important part. The other important part to recognize is a lot of these lawyers were genuinely afraid of what a Democratic administration would look like on their issues. They genuinely were closer to the Flight 93 belief that a Democratic administration would create permanent and irreversible damage to their fundamental existential interests. Again, very much not like national security conservatives, right? Lots of national security conservatives were more likely to say that, you know, our battle with the other side is between the 40-yard lines. Whereas these people, you know, really are in a deeply adversarial relationship with the other side, deeply zero sum.
And that point is accentuated with when the candidate is Hillary Clinton, because to national security conservatives, Hillary Clinton is a pretty anodyne figure. She is not by any means a kind of somebody who from the left rejects the liberal world order, right? She's an internationalist. She's not opposed to the use of military force. So if you're a national security conservative, you are not afraid of Hillary Clinton. But a legal conservative has been locked in this battle with her. And the sort of, I mean, when they think of the sort of thing that they're fighting against, both at the level of investigations that involve the Clintons, and also just at the level of what she represents substantively, there is a lot more fear of her individually than, for example, there might be with a Joe Biden-like figure.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, well, I wonder about that. I mean, I do think, at least for some of these people, right? I mean, some of the people on the legal side had literally been involved in the Whitewater investigation, had been hunting the Clintons for years, that kind of stuff. But I kind of think that the larger fact that there was, you know, A, the Scalia open seat mattered a lot. And that really sensitized people to the idea that this was a pivotal election over which irreversible change in the judiciary and thus the legal system was at stake. I think that's very much important. Now, I do think to some degree they saw Hillary as more likely to play hardball with them where law was concerned. But I think more they were likely to say, look, we've got two teams. We've got a team of conservative lawyers and a team of liberal lawyers. And both of these teams really want to entrench, you know, to use their political power to entrench themselves in the judiciary and the larger structures of the law. And if we lose, you know, if we lose this next 4 years, we're never going to get back. And that's where there's a big discussion of this Michael Anton Flight 93 article, the idea that this was a, you know, we literally were, you know, about to be, you know, the plane was likely to be taken over by the equivalent of terrorists. And unless you rushed the cockpit, that you were going to go down. And so lawyers were much more likely to see the world that way, right? To see it as this deeply zero sum and irreversible election in a way that national security conservatives didn't. And, you know, the difference between Biden and Clinton would have been somewhat relevant there. But I do think they mainly thought that whoever was a Democratic president would bring this other team in. And that other team really wanted to you know, make these people subordinate, right? Really wanted to rule them in a way that national security conservatives are more likely to see the person on the other side as really their counterpart between the 40-yard lines.
And so in addition to that, or the countervailing factor, is that for a lot of conservatives who have, legal conservatives, who have, you know, stressed for many years process regularity, rule of law issues, Trump is as jarring a figure as he is to non-conservatives who are, you know, interested in things like procedural regularity and rule of law. And so I'm interested in how those fights, how that tension played out. The result is a kind of split in the conservative legal movement that is not there in the, for example, the Republican foreign policy establishment.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, it is interesting that there is an actual organization called Checks and Balances that came out of legal conservatives who opposed Trump. But even with them, the thing that's interesting when you interview the people who were involved in that, even George Conway, who is about as over the top an opponent of Trump as it's possible to get, even he is likely to say that he loves the judicial appointments. So the first thing to say about lawyers as compared to national security is there is a kind of ambivalence there, right? Lots of people really don't like his relationship to judicial norms, the norms of the execution of the office. A lot of them also just dislike the generally shambolic performance of the administration where legal matters are concerned. And yet on the other hand, right, they would be really worried about other people being appointed to the judiciary from the other side. And in general, they know the people who are actually getting appointed to these judicial positions, and they like it. So, you know, I think that is really the division there. And part of it is when you look at the people who are most likely to have signed, there was an originalist against Trump letter that was very heavily weighted toward academic conservative lawyers. And I think that's not an accident that those people, and it, you know, operate inside of generally liberal institutions like law schools. And they take seriously the idea that they're in a long-term battle to actually persuade people of the rightness and legitimacy of principles like originalism. And I think the idea that Trump would cause lasting damage to those ideas, right? That those ideas would get tarred with Trump's brush and therefore never be able to get that sort of stink off them, really weighed heavily. Steve Sachs at Duke Law School and Will Bowditt at Chicago both said things like, and they were the ones who put together the originalist against Trump letter. They both really emphasized that one thing they were trying to do with the letter was to inoculate originalism against the stain of Trumpism.
And to what extent do you think that has been persuasive in a world in which originalism is both associated with a set of ideas, right? But it's also associated with the appointments that the president has made and the political valence of those appointments, even for people who are sympathetic to it. And you know, I have my areas of sympathy with it, though that's complicated. But we have now associated originalism with the political right, which is now the Trump right. And so to what extent do you think that is a tilting at windmills on the part of Steve Sachs and Will Bowdy and others? And to what extent do you think there has been a remotely or even marginally successful effort to insulate the ideas from the people?
I mean, my instinct is that probably not, right? It probably hasn't been very, very effective. Now, again, part of this is that the general force of political polarization is so powerful that it sort of sweeps everything, you know, in its wake. And so I do think, the project of sort of arguing that originalism was somehow above not just being a partisan project, which really is the project of people like Will and Steve and others like them. That's a really important idea for them, that they're not just partisans. And it's certainly in Will's case, right? I think Will really doesn't think of himself as a partisan, even though, you know, he clerked for McConnell and Roberts. But that's an increasingly hard position to maintain. And I do think when you look in the academy, that project of legitimating conservatism and creating a home for it, there are fewer and fewer liberals in the time of Trump who are willing to go along with that. And, you know, I haven't asked Will about this, but I do wonder whether the project of trying to persuade liberals of the merits of their ideas, which was a very important part, it was a very important part of the original Federalist Society design, to go back to the rise of the conservative legal movement, that the people who created that really thought there was an opportunity to engage in persuasion, right? That they, many of them had been liberals before. Steve Calabresi had been a liberal and he had been persuaded, and he thought that the design of the Federalist Society would really be able to bring people over to their side. And I do wonder whether that project is more or less at its end. And that's a really dangerous fact for our larger political system. I think the idea that parties previously thought about raiding the other party, that, you know, we didn't just have completely fixed battle lines, but you could actually do raids around the flank of the other party and take away part of their coalition, was actually a very important democratic stabilizing mechanism, because it meant that you didn't just think that it was trench warfare. But increasingly, neither party really thinks that they can actually steal components away from the other party's coalition. And that's where politics really does start looking more like civil war.
So, and yet, I want to make an argument that your book here is a reflection of the fact that parties are stealing, at least intellectual elites, from each other. So, you know, when you take the checks and balances group that you describe, many of whose founders are, you know, associated with Lawfare, one of the things that I think is interesting about a group like that is a chunk of the intellectual elite of the Republican legal establishment. I mean, when you take away the Orrin Kerrs and the John Adlers and the Peter Keislers and the George Conways, and you either, and I don't know what the future holds, make them the sort of conservative wing of the Democratic Party, or whether you make them kind of politically homeless, or whether you, one thing you are doing is you're depriving the conservative movement of that, and you are disrupting the idea that you have these two parties, each with their own intellectual bench that is substantial and deep and intellectually compelling. And that's even more dramatic on the national security side. I mean, there simply is no prominent group of national security intellectuals who, in a sustained, serious way, will make the arguments for what this president has done and is representing. And so I'm actually wondering whether the turning of the Federalist Society from a body that persuades, which it really did for many, many years, and a body that engaged in serious argument, to essentially a Republican interest group and networking organization that actually stands for very little except for the appointment of our people to the bench and to executive branch positions. Is the effect really to denude the party of its intellectual bench?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the question of the Federalist Society is complicated, in that if you were to ask a bunch of the people involved in checks and balances, they would still say that they are Federalist Society members in good standing. And, you know, I think if you were to ask John Adler, he would be happy to say that, right? That he participates in the Federalist Society. He's involved with it. He thinks it's important. And I think he also thinks that there's a lot of Federalist Society members who, for various reasons, are having to engage in a degree of preference falsification, but are really uncomfortable with the way this administration has operated. But to go back to the general point, you know, the overall framing of the book, that these are professional groupings who provide services to the party, right? Those are important services. Those are services that that need to be performed. And if they can't be performed, there are real consequences. And I think, you know, the fact that they've had to operate without a lot of the more talented lawyers, without a lot of the more talented economists and national security experts, has had real consequences for this administration, even in pursuing its own ideas, right? There are a lot of the decisions that have been made by the administration in environmental areas and other ones that have gotten struck down by the courts, in large part just as a result of just bad lawyering. When you think about why was it this administration was so unable to put together anything to reverse Obamacare, that was not accidental to the fact that they did not have most of the really serious economists who could actually put together proposals working with this this administration. And I think in some ways the response to COVID-19, which has had very significant consequences for Trump's capacity to get reelected, it can really be directly traced to the fact that it's having to operate with the B team, or to some degree now, right, with the C team. And so all of that, I think, in a way, the Never Trump people, while they certainly weren't able to stop Trump or get or stop his hold over the Republican Party mass base, have through their absence had a real consequence for the quality of this administration's, you know, performance in office, and thus ultimately their success as a governing establishment.
And what do you think is the future of the Never Trump movement, both in the legal establishment and in the national security establishment? Is it like the Scoop Jackson Democrats of the late 70s who kind of drift into the Republican Party and become what we think of now as the neoconservatives? Is it more a rebellion that gets put down and they kind of fritter out into non-existence and political quietism? Or is it something else? I mean, does this have, in a two-party system, I mean, if we were in Germany, they would start a new party, but that's not going to happen in the United States. So what's the future of it? Is it just going to drift away, or is it going to become some kind of intellectual force, either an insurgent force within the Republican Party as it has been, or a kind of deepening and broadening of the Democratic coalition?
Well, so I do think the parallel to the neoconservatives is not right, because you really can't underestimate how much political polarization matters, you know, how far apart these parties fundamentally are. And the important thing to recognize about most of these Never Trump conservatives is they're conservative, right? I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, I think some of them, you know, like Jim Rubin and Max Boot have come to rethink some significant parts of their ideological coloration. But a lot of them continue to think of themselves as conservatives and have very large disagreements with the general beliefs of the Democratic Party, even as some of them are willing to work with it because they think that they're in a kind of national emergency. And that's why I think the future of Never Trump conservatives is really to be the kind of professional and intellectual establishment of a minority but pivotal faction in the Republican Party. In the end of the book, we suggest that both of the Democratic and the Republican parties are likely to be more factionally divided into deeply organized groups who negotiate with each other internally. And so I do think that there's going to be a kind of dominant populist faction of the Republican Party, with a base in the South and West, and to some degree Midwest, and a dissident liberal, what we call liberal conservative faction, that's going to have a different geographical base, is going to have a different material base in terms of who's funding it, but without which the dominant populist faction will not be able to actually acquire power. And so I think a lot of these guys are going to stay in the Republican Party, but they're going to be creating a durable faction without that the populist faction of the Republican Party is going to have to negotiate with.
I wish I thought you were right, but I actually don't. I'll leave us on this note of discord. I think the experience of Donald Trump is so traumatizing to a lot of these people that a whole bunch of them have come to actually identify emotionally and intellectually with the other party and its interests. And that's not to say that they agree on policy issues, but they feel in their guts that the other side winning is important. I think that feeling is the core of political identity, not policy, and that the reorientation of conservative intellectual elites toward the Democratic Party is likely to have very substantial implications both for the Republican Party and for the Democratic Party in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's unlikely that a lot of these guys are, in fact, going to find a home in the Democratic Party. That is, they may be voting for them in this election and very much hoping the Democrats win. But to imagine that they're actually, you know, that any Democratic president, even as moderate as Biden, would appoint Elliot Cohen to a position in the State or Defense Department or the National Security Council is extremely hard to imagine. And again, that's where I think the underlying dynamic of polarization matters so much. And again, my scenario of a minority Republican faction is not even what I would consider to be the highest probability option. But I think I'm less interested in prediction than I am in building scenarios for people who actually have decisions to make. Part of what we argue in the conclusion of the book is that, you know, how history goes is in part shaped by consequential decisions that people make in pivotal moments. And I do think that one big criticism I have of Never Trumpers is they, in a way, invested too much in building linkages with Democrats to support, you know, the rule of law and democratic norms, as opposed to actually doing the deep, hard work of building a party faction inside the Republican Party. So they're really over 3 years behind in that project, but they're going to have to start doing it now because there's really no alternative. There's no third party. There's no, you know, disassociated nonpartisan center that's out there, right? You really do in polarized, you know, conditions, you really have to pick a party and work within it. And if it's not the Republican Party, I don't think they have much of a future in the Democrats.
The book is Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. It is by Robert P. Salden and our guest, Steve Tellis. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your audio engineer this week was Zachary Frank. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and share us widely. The Lawfare Podcast is produced, as always, by Jen Patia Howell, and your music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks so much for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.